Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
My name is Nathan Opson, and I'm a host for New Books in Japanese Studies, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Sujin Lee about her book, Wombs of Empire, Population Discourses and Biopolitics in Modern Japan. The book is out from Stanford University Press in 2023. In 2007, Japan's health minister referred to women ages 15 to 50 as birthing machines. The context for this remark was a speech about Japan's declining birth rate and its projected population shrinkage. As Lee shows in Wombs of Empire, neither population anxieties nor the idea of women as childbearing devices whose wombs were the property of the state are new. However, when the so-called population problem became a public preoccupation for politicians, scientists, and activists in the 1910s, it was an expression of worries about overpopulation and carrying capacity in a resource-poor nation and empire. Wombs of Empire traces the trajectory of population discourses and practices from these years through wartime Japan, with particular attention to the ways in which notions of motherhood were constructed hierarchically within the context of empire and war, and how Malthusian population control discourses formulated by leftists, feminists, scientists, and politicians gave way to the natalism of total war. Okay, Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. So I'd like to first start off by asking you how it is that you became interested in the set of sort of research questions and problems that became the book Wombs of Empire.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me, Nathan. Just as many first-time book authors in academia, this book project started out from my dissertation, research on different streams of population discourse during the interwar period in Japan. From the beginning of the dissertation project to the completion of this book, I believe it spans almost over a decade, if I want to include my PhD training. There were some important moments that shaped and reshaped the essential nature of this book. So to give you some instances of those integral moments, first, I was drawn into this concept of population problem. In Japanese, it's called Jinko Mondai. During my second year of the PhD program, and I worked on a research paper at the time on Abe Iso, who's a Japanese Christian socialist and activist and intellectual in the Pearl period, mainly as part of my final assignment submitted to the course on materialist theories. And when you go through Abe Iso's career, even quickly on Wikipedia, you'd be struck by enormously wide range of his activism and areas of writing, ranging from the leftist labor movement to the campaign for the abolition of licensed prostitution, birth control, and later eugenics movement. He was involved in various movements like these. And I was particularly interested in his involvement in the birth control movement, which he promoted among mainly the Japanese working class people as early as 1920s. And his commitment to the birth control campaigns was framed as solutions to the pressing population problem that he called Jingo Mundai. And Abe, just like his fellow birth control advocates at the time, considered especially overpopulation as a source of many socioeconomic crises faced by Japan at the time, and the ways in which population became linked with these economic issues, such as unemployment and poverty, etc., helped me reconsider the often dismissed link between production and reproduction in a capitalist society, where the latter, reproduction, was relegated into the background of social life, but at the same time, you see that it becomes subject to social, governmental, and medical control. So, although many feminist Marxist scholars have brought to the fore the issues of social reproduction in terms of labor that goes into the reproduction of workers in a capitalist context, I wanted to take this question of reproduction further to think about how not only social reproduction, but also biological reproduction, that is a very much naturalized domain of human life, is in fact regulated and informed by various social practices and also actors in their attempt to address issues of capitalist production. That discussion I made in my final research paper at the time led the foundation of my dissertation later. And in my dissertation, I examined the trajectory of various social movements and knowledge production during the interwar period that worked toward addressing what they call population problem in their own distinctive ways. And Abe Isu was one of the main figures I examined in my dissertation as part of my discussion on neo-Malthusian birth control advocates and their interlinking vision of population control, race betterment and eugenic grounds, and also economic and social reform. And another source of inspiration in terms of shaping my shaping the essence of my book is that my book was finally able to incorporate gender analysis thanks to some inspiring and insightful interactions that I had with colleagues and researchers in the fields of gender history or gender and feminism studies. Initially, I was planning to expand my dissertation to include population discourse in the wartime period, so I could examine some continuities between the interwar and wartime period, in the sense that population, or in Japanese, jinko, gradually became a focal point of governance, medical intervention, and intellectual discussion, especially in the discipline of social sciences. If I had pursued that discussion in my book, the book could have looked very different from what it is now. And I believe that I could have suffered from some regrets on the absence of the essential discussion, such as gender, aspects of population, discourse of reproduction, and motherhood, that were at the heart of population discourse, so that were supposed to be there in my discussion. Luckily, or I should say regrettably and luckily, it took some time for me to reach that realization that I need a gender lens to illuminate the complexity of population discourse, especially simultaneously inclusionary and exclusionary politics that were embedded in the language, movements, and also knowledge regarding population control. And thanks to those fellow researchers I've been interacting with in various occasions over the past few years, I was able to revisit my manuscript and reformulated the theme of my manuscript to bring a gender lens into my discussion and about population and reproduction. And as a result, the book came to have a chapter on the wartime population policy and its ideological and institutional construction of motherhood, especially Japanese motherhood. And on top of that, I analyzed eugenic feminism that pursued the intertwined logic of maternal feminism and eugenic principles of race betterment. during the interwar and the wartime period. So my attempt to dissect the discourse of motherhood was very integral to de-essentializing, or you can call it denaturalizing, women's reproductive experiences or their bodies and even the category of woman itself. And also by doing so, I wanted to illuminate how the concept of population is neither merely quantifiable demographic data, nor just a totalized form of life, as Michel Foucault often puts it, but it is a malleable, unstable, divergent, and engendered entity that requires various mechanisms to sustain it. On a side note, I would add that the title of this book, Worms of Empire, was decided in the later stage of writing. I believe that having a final title is it really comes in the later stage. I think this is most writers' experiences. I should give half of the credit to my amazing editor, Dylan, at Stanford, who kindly suggested me to change the original title. It was pretty dull. And he suggested that he suggested a very clearly articulated subtitle. But the main title, Worms of Empire, was inspired by the book I was reading at the time, luckily. It's called The Wombs of Women. It's by Françoise Berger. I don't think I pronounced her name correctly. I'm not a French speaker. But the author is an activist and historian whom I never met, but she enlightened me with her brilliant book on the medical colonial violence against gendered and racialized women in the French island of Reunion. And I wanted to mention this to emphasize again how both direct and indirect interactions with scholars in gender and feminism studies along my writing journey guided me in the critical approach to the history of population discourse in the Japanese national and imperial context. And I really appreciate all the insights that made this book possible and richer.
Well, and I appreciate you giving us a really in-depth look at sort of how, not only how the book is sort of structured and put together, but, you know, the elements that went into it, but why they're there and what they're doing. I want to maybe back out just a little bit and take a look at some of the big issues that you lay out in your introduction and your epilogue, and then we'll look at the two parts, essentially, of the book, which are each three chapters. So starting in the introduction, you lay out the premise that, and I want to quote you here, population is a critical site where different visions of modernity play out. And you're starting from this point, you explore how in the Japanese Empire, bodies were not only massified in the form of population, but also differentiated and excluded along the lines of gender and race. And you've already started to talk about this quite eloquently in your in the introduction you just gave. But I wanted to highlight that again because I have some questions about those themes. So first, and again, I think you've touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to sort of have you dig down into the question of why is it that the relationship between population and modernity specifically is important and interesting for you? To me, it seems like maybe one way to answer this would be to start with your argument that, as you put it, population discourse arose in response to the predicament of modernity. So already you're sort of putting the two together there, but I hope you can unpack that a little bit for us.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the wonderful question. It is a very fundamental question. I believe it requires some long-winded answers, so I hope you bear with me. I believe it is precisely because of the concept of modernity that is such an abstract term. So it's a simultaneously problematic and productive one. And on the one hand, it is problematic because a term has prescribed certain norms, ideas, and practices regarding what ought to be modern, and the imposition of modernity in the history of Japanese context comes with a so-called Western-modeled nation building, nation state building, and transformation into a capitalist society, aspiration to become a colonizer like other Western empires in the context of 19th century, 20th century international order, and also some fascination with the idea of progress. So those are the images and norms about modernity in the context of only 19th century and 20th century. But as some scholars, as like Henry Haritanu, for example, notes in his book, what Japanese intellectuals witnessed in the interwar period was what Haritanu calls unevenness, uneven temporality, specifically coeval presence of different temporalities that did not fit into those norms that I just described of modern in reality. Indeed, the lived experience of quote-unquote modern does not follow the history with capital H, but only creates a gap or chasm between modern as a prescriptive regime and modern as lived experiences. And it is this gap that I wanted to delve into further to think about social anxieties that were shared among social reformers, labor activists, and population scientists, driven by their lived experiences of modern that were filled with class inequalities or regional inequalities, social and political unrest, or poverty and diseases, etc. The list goes on. And what caught my interest particularly was that their anxieties were expressed with the term population problem. And this term, population problem, or jinko mondai, was actually a buzzword during the interwar period, especially since the late 1910s, when economic issues and social inequalities became increasingly pronounced. And this got me wondering why such collective anxieties about how modernity unfolded unevenly were reductively called the population issue. Another question that I raised as I was going through primary sources, when these various groups called for the solution of the population problem, did they define the problem in the same way, let alone proposing the same solution? And the ways in which socioeconomic issues faced by Japanese society at the time were framed as a problem of reproduction, more specifically the problem of having either too many people to feed or too many workers to feed into this limited employment pool, that allows us to understand that population is essentially a site where different visions of modernity were translated into simply a problem of the body, and different solutions to the predicament of modernity were proposed vis-a-vis the control of the body. And in the meantime, I mentioned earlier that there's also a productive aspect of the concept modernity in the sense that at an analytical level, it provides a tool to illuminate particular historical patterns and also tensions that were experienced differently at a local level. And as to modernity as an analytical tool, I'm specifically referring to Foucault's discussion of biopolitics and governmentality. And as you may have noticed, or admittedly, my analysis of population discourse in the context of Japan proper and more broadly in the context of Japanese colonial empire was inspired by Foucault's discussion of biopolitics and population as a target of government, which is a salient symptom of modernity in his view. That said, my own dialogue with Foucauldian biopolitics was not used in the way that I apply his theoretical account of frameworks blindly to the specific context of modern Japan. Instead, I wanted to make this concept at a even more productively in my analysis of population, or jinko in Japanese. A critical approach to the concept of biopolitics and also population was necessary and also essential because, like how Foucault conceptualized the birth of population as if it was a homogenized and totalized entity that was subject to modern governance and modern knowledge. In fact, in the lived experiences of population in Japan, you see that population was always in the making. And moreover, it involved not only inclusionary politics, but also exclusionary politics. To put more simply, the boundary of the population was unstable. And it was particularly the case when the Japanese Empire had to incorporate colonized bodies from Korea and Taiwan into the pool of so-called readily mobilizable human resources to wage the war. Another worth mentioning point is that the female reproductive body became instrumental to the regulation of the quantity and quality of the population. The idea of motherhood, for example, was also the motherhood protection was first promoted by maternal feminists and some birth control advocates during the interwar period. And later, this idea was picked up by the wartime government in the pursuit of improving the quality of what they call human resources. The wombs of women, in this case, Japanese women, in particular, were considered as a source of the health of the Japanese race and the security of the nation. So such a gender aspect of population control is virtually, I believe, absent in Foucault's account of biopolitics. And this limitation motivated me to engage with his framework of population from a critical distance so that I could challenge the gender-blinded and European-centric framework of modernity using a gender and historical lens.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, I think that's a really useful, not only, you know, explanation of what you're doing, but also a great transition into the next question that I have for you. Because you were talking about sort of the ways that these politics and ideologies of modernity and population are projected differentially onto individual bodies, massified or micro-massified bodies. And so the question that I have for you then is exactly how these different treatments arise, different treatments of bodies arise, and what do they mean? And for you, what was it that made you feel that specifically the construction of motherhood as a sort of discursive concept was the way to approach this problem in thinking about population in modern Japan?
That's another great question, and I try to answer to that question throughout my book, either implicitly or explicitly. I hope that I did a good job. So, as mentioned earlier, population is not a fixed or objective concept, like it is often assumed in a demographic sense. I believe its malleability lies in the fact that different modes of power constantly attempt to draw lines between different bodies so that the boundary between the inside and the outside can be defined and redefined and also managed. For example, during the Asia-Pacific War, the wartime regime created the Ministry of Health and Welfare, which is Kosisho in Japanese, for the first time to govern various administrative tasks needed to optimize the size and health of the Japanese population. And I call this emergence of the state's role and institutional intervention into the population management so-called the rise of biopolitical state. And this term biopolitical state is used to highlight how the total state that was often considered as irrational, feudal, or fascist regime in earlier historiography of Japan. In fact, they orchestrated knowledge and institution to create the system of the population management, including welfare and insurance policies, motherhood and childhood assistance programs, eugenic laws, and population science research. Here, my intention is not to make any value-laden judgment about the wartime government's contribution to the creation of the welfare system, but my goal here is to cast new light on the wartime regime embodying certain biopolitical modernity to pursue the systematic scientific management of bodies. Going back to my earlier point, it is amidst this increasing state intervention in the quantity and quality of the population during the wartime where motherhood, or in Japanese, bosei, had become the focal point of the population governance. under the slogan of healthy soldiers and healthy people, in Japanese, Kenpei can mean the wartime state, along with population scientists and eugenicists at the time, developed programs and campaigns to ensure the increase in the population size, or more precisely, the size of human resources, and also the improvement of the quality on eugenic grounds. And so it is conceivable why women's reproductive function and their bodies had become integral to the state's war mobilization policies. One of the primary reasons for this book to be titled Women's Empire is to emphasize that instrumentality of women's reproductive function in the population governance. And the investment in young women's bodies, whether they were expecting or would be in the future as expected by the state, by providing financial and medical assistance systematically, unveils the underlying gender politics of the biopolitical state, that is to say, foregrounding motherhood as a source of the health of future citizens and ultimately the source of national strength. This particular care invested in women's reproductive function or their body bears complexity if we bring the historical narratives of the Japanese colonial empire into the picture. Toward the end of the Asia-Pacific War, the empire had no choice but extended the limit of the population to include Korean and Taiwanese bodies as those now eligible for health and welfare policies. As many of you, many listeners know, Takashi Fujitani in his book Race for Empire used using the term polite racism, he explained about this. And the integration of male colonial bodies from colonial Korea and Taiwan into mobilizable human resources accompanied the changes in the colonial discourse of motherhood and reproduction as well. That's an interesting part that I discovered through my research. But as I argue in the later chapters of my book, pronatalist policies or welfare programs in these colonies, Korea and Taiwan, did not develop into a full-fledged ones. And only rhetorical aspects were pronounced to imbue these colonized mothers with the idea of imperial mothers. And in addition to this, as discussed in my last chapter, fifth chapter, if you compare the wartime state and medical intervention into the Japanese mothers to the systematic mobilization of sexual slaves, which primarily targeted women from the colonies, it is easily conjectured that the biopolitical state delineated the boundary between those who are worthy of procreation and others who are not, so who do not deserve the state protection, but only exploitation. And as just mentioned, the concept of population inherently involves the work of delineating the boundary between the inside and outside, because the limit of the bodies deserving the state protection should be sustained. This boundary, though, does not necessarily concern racial or gender differentiation, but also can be drawn within the national or ethnic group as well. For example, how the wartime and even post-war eugenic world in Japan actually legitimize the sterilization of individuals with certain hereditary diseases or a few non-hereditary diseases like leprosy, for example, reveal the contingent nature of boundary. The fact that the state could legitimately deprive the group of people of the rights of procreation for the sake of the population quality reminds us that the politics of inclusion and exclusion takes place at multiple levels and also along multiple lines, even including at genetic levels.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that's most sort of striking about the book is as you say, the multiple levels on which the divisions of the modern sort of biopoliticalized population are happening. And so you explore that in more depth, of course, in the two parts, six chapters of the book. And the first part is the sort of inter-warriors proper, if you will, And then the second part is, you know, depending on how you define wartime, we're getting into wartime in the 1930s. And so I want to look at those first three chapters in which, you know, as you said, it's more about these sort of Malthusian anxieties about population control and limited resources, the Jinko Mondai, or where it intersects with my work, the Jinko Shokuryo Mondai. That sort of, you know, it was, again, very interesting for me reading this. So in this context, you're looking at some of the knowledge practices and policies vis-a-vis population, both quantity and quality, from various points of view, right? And so this was, I guess, the other side of what we were just talking about, which is that it's not just that the divisions are happening on multiple levels, but that there are so many different actors who are involved with doing the discursive work, at least, of creating those divisions. So you have Marxists, you have feminists, you have establishment scholars, you have bureaucrats, politicians. And so what ties all of these groups that you look at specifically in the first chapter together in their vision of the population problem? And conversely, how do they end up different? Because, of course, they do. Otherwise, you wouldn't have spent, you know, different chapters on them.
As you just effectively summarize, this book is arranged in both chronological and thematic order, and the first two chapters examine interwar population discourse that variously constituted and responded to what they call the population problem. And in these three chapters, I examine what I call, I quote myself, the cacophony of population discourse in the 1920s and 30s, which essentially indicates multifaceted versions of reconstructing modernity through population governance. As described with the word of cacophony, the notion of population problem did not mean a single issue, but it was defined multiple ways by a different group of intellectuals and activists. And also depending on how they define what the problem was or what the core issue was, their solutions also varied. For example, as I examined in the first chapter, Japanese neo-Malthusians and leftists, they articulate the problem differently in the interwar period. The history of neo-Malthusians and leftist birth control movements during that time, roughly from the late 1910s through early 1930s, this history reveals growing interest in the quantity and the quality of the Japanese population among social reformers, socialists, and labor activists who sought an all-embracing biological solution to a variety of socioeconomic challenges. And here I should note that I did not make up the term quantity and quality of the population in Japanese, jinko no ryō to shitsu. But actually, many social scientists and labor activists, for example, as we can see from the debate, it's a very open-sided debate between Takada Yasuma and Kawakami Hajime. They have a debate over the population issue in the late 1920s. But anyway, many intellectuals at the time often used this term, quantity and quality of the population, when they engage with discussion about various demographic issues. And the ways in which the problem is presented in a dual sense, that is, quantity and quality, indicates the intertwined influences of, for example, statistics, especially census that started in 1920 in Japan proper, but earlier in Taiwan, Japan's colony. And other influences came from eugenics and also ongoing debates between Malthusian advocates and Marxists over the cause of poverty and inequality in European and American contexts. So these are another influences that constitute this discussion around quantity and quality of the population. And coming back to the Japanese neo-Malthusian advocates and leftists, although both used the notion of population problem, but interestingly, they had conflicting views on the definition of the population problem. More specifically for neo-Malthusianists, the gist of the problem was overpopulation, mainly caused by, from their views, unchecked fertility. In the meantime, for leftists, it was essentially class issues, structurally caused by capitalism and unequal distribution of resources. And you can think that this was very much aligned with Marx or Lenin's denunciation of Malthus' principle of population. as they argued that overpopulation was a bourgeois rhetoric, but it's not actually a real problem. The real problem is already embedded in the capitalist system. And many Japanese leftists follow that line too. But despite this different interpretation of this problem, both neo-Malthusianist and leftist presidential advocates played a crucial role in reconfiguring reproduction as a fundamental cause, as well as source of solution for the modern crisis facing the Japanese society at the time. And it is precisely this different or even conflicting vision embedded in the population discourse that caught my attention to this multifaceted layer of the population discourse during the interwar period. Two feminist birth control advocates, Yamaka Kikue and Ishimoto Shize, or Kato Shize, she changed her name later, added interesting voice regarding motherhood. They both adopted the term voluntary motherhood from American birth control activist Margaret Sanger. When it comes to Yamaka Kikue, socialist feminist Yamaka Kikue, she argued for working class women's reproductive choice to liberate them from both capitalism and patriarchy. What is interesting about her argument is that she also criticized the patriarchal aspect, patriarchal hierarchy within the class movement. So she also made an argument that even if, let's say that there's a revolution and there's a proletarian state that arose, then still women's reproductive choice or their freedom had to be maintained. That was her argument, which was, even from the current point of view, it was pretty radical argument that could be made at the time. Going back to these two feminist birth control advocates, Ishimoto Shize, on the other hand, she adopted the same term, voluntary motherhood, but she fused her birth control advocacy with eugenic ideas to emphasize that women's reproductive autonomy will lead to elevating their status in the nation by producing healthy offspring, therefore contributing to the race betterment. So you see the rhetoric of eugenics in our argument. Despite their obviously different political position, actually both feminists, Ishimoto and Yamakawa, their arguments can be tied together in the sense that both of them foregrounded women's reproductive autonomy in ultimately addressing Japan's imperialist expansion and militarism, capitalist exploitation, and patriarchal oppression, all of which are, from their views, the symptoms of gendered modernity. And lastly, I also examined some population scientists who were involved in the interwar governments or semi-government population research committees. For example, Jinku Shokuyo Mondai Josakai, I translated as Population and Food Problems Investigation Committee. The other one is Jinku Mondai Kenkyukai, which is Population Problem Research Society. As I mainly discussed in my chapter three, leading scholars who mediated between population science and policy, such as Nagai Toru, who is a social policy expert, and also well-known figure Nitobe Inazo, who's a diplomat, and also agricultural economist, they show another layer of the population discourse, especially those who are involved in the population research group within the government. They highlighted the broader dimensions of the population problem that cannot be reduced into either a poverty issue, as many neo-Malthusianists argued, or unemployment issues, as many leftists birth control advocates argued. Instead, they argued, government research think tank or scholars argued that population issues are associated with multifaceted historical, social, economic, and even biological problems. So this problem requires extensive research and the state's leading role in governing a range of domains related to the population management. That was their more extensive definition of the population problem. And what should be noted here is that colonial expansion and extraction of resources were also considered by this government research group, Nito Beinazzo, for example, is one of the leading advocates who was initially negative about the mass migration of Japanese people in the colonies. So it's settler colonialism, but he was very negative about it. But instead, he advocated for colonial expansion and development of colonial economy as a solution to the overpopulation issues in Japan proper. And this reveals the indispensability of colonial expansion in the development of biopolitical population governance in the metropole, so in Japan proper. And such a vision was eventually incorporated into agrarian colonization campaign with the creation of Machiko in 1932. And now you see that how militarism and this biopolitical vision was fused together after 1930s.
Yeah, and that's, again, you've done a great job of segueing here, because I was just about to say that, you know, to get into part two, right, you start actually to do that in chapter three of the book by doing this sort of bridging across, talking about how population science is operating against the background of the Japanese foundation of this sort of puppet regime of Manchukuo in Manchuria. And so your remaining chapters four through six, look at wartime population policies, not wartime proper in the sense of the Pacific War, World War II, but sort of this long 15-year war under increasing mobilization and eventually total mobilization. And I think more importantly for sort of our purposes, this kind of maturing and matured biopolitical state. So one characteristic of the new regime that you point out here is the sort of reduction of the population, you know, more thoroughly to just resources, to human resources, for the purposes of the state. But even within that, there's this sort of instrumentalized, massified population. But even within that, there are these remaining divisions, these differentiations along lines of gender, race, class. Also, in the sense that you're talking about the different spatialities of the empire, there's also these spatial differences. So how is this then, how are all these hierarchies actually enacted at the level of these sort of natalist policies and the state control of the reproductive bodies of women?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the question. It is interesting to see how the population discourse changed with the outbreak of the Sino-Japanese War in 1937, and later it expanded into the Pacific War. But at the same time, you see that, as I argue in my book, how the total war government, in fact, materialized and even maximized various interwar visions for the population management. The salient difference between these 2 years will be that the focus on population changes from finding solutions to overpopulation to increasing the size of the human resources. Now the language changes also, like from population to human resources. And another dimension is improving their health, which is quality issue. And despite this different foci, you see some continuities as well between the two eras in terms of the maximization of modern systematic and scientific intervention in a selected population. So as I mainly discuss in chapter four, the establishment of COSISHO, the Ministry of Health and Welfare, as a primary body responsible for population governance is integral to the emergence of the biopolitical state. And under the leadership of COSISHO, various pronatalist and eugenic policies and campaigns were implemented to make what is called umeobiyaseyo, give birth and multiply, and kempekemin, healthy soldiers and healthy people, to materialize. And here you see two different vectors working simultaneously toward the making of the population. One is incorporating different bodies under the category of the population, and the other is differentiating bodies along gender, racial, and other lines. And I believe that you beautifully summarized that. Thanks for that. The instrumentalization of motherhood during wartime is in that sense very essential to this bordering of the population. On the one hand, there was an increasing number of campaigns and welfare policies invested in maternal bodies. In chapter 5, I took the example of what is called National Commendation for Families with Many Healthy Children in Japanese Yuyu Hashikate Hyosho. Those who had more than 10 children, they were awarded this commendation, and they were called Fertile Womb Battalion. Very, how should I put it? It's a very, very colonialist and very family-oriented term, but at the same time, you can see the militaristic tone from that. The other example that I gave in my chapter 5 is Handbook for the Expectant Mothers or Ninsa Potential in Japanese. This is another example of how the state invested in maternal body during the wartime for the sake of the protection of the Japanese mothers. The wartime government's co-opting of existing feminist thoughts appears to be good for women's empowerment, or at least for their welfare. But if you delve deeper into the underlying logic of motherhood protection, it was less concerned with the empowerment of women than with the reinforcement of gender roles by glorifying women's reproductive roles as their quote-unquote natural vocation. And in other words, their fertility was the only ground for women to be recognized by the nation. If we pay attention to this historical construction of nationalist motherhood as a vital instrument for the state's population control during wartime, we find gender politics situated at the heart of population discourse, far from being peripheral. Here, we should not overlook that there was more than the gender binary that enacted differentiation deployed by the wartime regime. What should be noted here is that the gendering of citizenship intersected with racial and class lines to differentiate women who were entitled to be mothers from those whose motherhood must be denied, and so those who were excluded from the state protection. The history of so-called comfort women or military sexual slaves, as I mentioned briefly earlier, they were mobilized across the Japanese colonial empire, and their experience exemplify how not only inclusion but also exclusion worked in the reordering of life during wartime. Comfort women were deemed to be women unfit for procreation or reproduction. Instead, they were forced to serve for quote-unquote comforting tasks, namely sexual instruments for the purpose of satisfying masculine / imperialist desires. As I briefly note toward the end of my chapter 5, it is not my intention to contrast these two bodies, mothers and comfort women, as if they represent in a hierarchical relationship. Although it is crucial to acknowledge the magnitude of violence suffered by Japanese military sex slaves during the wartime and of course afterwards, I believe it is also important to understand the different instrumentalities deployed by the wartime regime against women's bodies as a whole. In other words, the biopolitical rationality remade Japanese mothers into a womb for the Japanese nation, while they also justified the exploitative violence against comfort women in the name of the protection of male soldiers. So for both bodies, surveillance was put into practice in the form of medical intervention, and that did not intend to protect the health of those women's bodies, but only to secure the health of male human resources. And given this, Japanese mothers and comfort women were not at opposite poles from each other, but they were constructed differently as on the one hand wombs, on the other hand as vaginas, by different modes of biopolitical intervention.
Yeah, and I think this is it's one of the things that really struck me about the book is that, you know, while you are definitely writing a very specific historical text, it's depressingly relevant to the ways that population questions and questions of national strength are still talked about today in Japan. I mean, if you listen to the way that politicians and the business papers, for example, talk about the word kokuryoku, national power, it's basically, the word is basically a synonym for population, right? And this is the freak out over the fact that Japan's population is decreasing. There's I think it's more than a correlation, it's a causation in the minds of these, you know, the sort of moral panic anxiety folks, between the sense that 128 million versus 125, well, we've lost 3 million units of kokuryoku, right, of national power. And it really made me think a great deal about, you know, the very infamous 2007 incident in which Japan's health minister referred to women aged 15 to 50 as umukikai, as birthing machines, right? And all these sort of ways in which so much of what you've been exploring in the book is, as I said, sort of depressingly relevant. And so is this idea that, you know, in a sense, the other half of the Malthusian problem, right, is not just overpopulation or underpopulation, but also under-resourcedness, right? And this idea that Japan is resource poor, and so then the only resources you have are people, and then those people have to go out and get the other resources, whether that's land or other natural resources. And so, again, I think this is one of those times when, you know, it's always dangerous to take a history book and say, and look at how, and look at today, and sort of line them up as perfect parallels. But I was very much struck by those parallels and how useful they are in thinking about how these sort of tropes of population have become part of the discourse. And that, please feel free to comment on that if you want to, but I had a question that follows from that, which is, given how sort of, again, relevant your work is to the world that we live in now, I'm wondering what it is that you're doing now that you have the book out and you're, after 10 years, able to focus on something else, a new project or maybe an extension, offshoot of this project. What is it that you're up to these days?
I believe that I will continue my earlier discussion, but in a different way or from different angle. I think that as you just described that population issue, which is more critical now in Japan. I believe that many East Asian countries like South Korea and China also is suffering from the similar problem, like birth rate has been dropping in the past decade. And then you see that how the government is trying to encourage women to give birth more. It's basically, so I didn't expect that my book would be read like this way in the current context. But what happened is, I believe that my book is just a preview of that what's unfolding now. Yeah, it's interesting. But currently, I'm working on a new project on the politics of abortion in 20th century. This project extends my other discussion in my book on the biopolitics of reproduction, but I will attempt to reorient the question of reproduction to examine what I call non-reproductive experiences of women, such as abortion, sterilization, birth control, or family planning, especially in the context of cold war period, right? So the reason for focusing on women's reproductive experiences other than childbirth is that I would like to unsettle so-called the liberalist feminist binary of pro-choice and pro-life, as we often see in American context. Not that I do not support of women's bodily autonomy, but I think this binary and especially this convenient association between women's reproductive freedom with only abortion rights seems to be inadequate to fully grasp the complex situation that has happened in Japan throughout 20th century and even today. For example, in Japan, in the post-war period, you see the enforcement of the eugenic protection law, which lasted about 5 decades, surprisingly. And under this law, you see that how the government legalized a certain group of people with certain types of hereditary disease to go through abortion legally. And in fact, it had less to do with the protection of bodily autonomy and reproductive rights, but more to do with, again, curbing the population size. Now that the things have changed in the war time period, government said that women of Brazil give birth to more babies in the post-war period. Now we have to decrease the size of the population. It's a very interesting change. But again, the state control, that what state desire and what medical intervention wants to achieve you see some similar patterns. And the other thing is in the Pusher period, as the name of the law said, eugenic was another important principle that guided this kind of policy. And the government wanting to improve the population quality as well in the Pusher period under this law. And given this structural condition that promoted non-reproductive choices of certain bodies among the population, it is crucial to understand where the line is drawn between the body that is worthy of procreation and other bodies that had to stay infertile. And in this project, one thing that I would do differently from the first book, The Wombs of Empire, as sort of my own experiment, is that I want to focus on women's own narratives that represent their experiences and their voice about their about abortion, sterilization, and contraception using various literature and also memoir or other type of life writing. And I would like to weave their stories with the bigger structural history of population control, such as eugenic laws that I just described, family planning campaigns, some media landscape, and medical or genetic technology, all of which were involved in what I call the biopolitics of non-reproductivity. And I hope that my second book, if ever made it to the finish line, can contribute to our understanding of the current issues that not only Japan, but many other societies is currently experiencing.
Well, we will definitely be looking forward to that second book, and hopefully we'll be able to have you back for that sometime soon, sometime within the next 10 years. But I know it does take some time, but I'm very much looking forward to it. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk through your book with us today.
Thank you so much.